This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around us. There are men and women that you're going to be pretty surprised when you take the time to find out what they've done for the sake of our freedom. Maybe even right down the street from you, there are some incredible stories. And that's what we're going to learn today from 94-year-old Eddie Fail, or Frenchie as they called him during his days as a naval aviator. He's a recipient of the Navy Cross. That is not a small feat, and we're going to find out how that happened. Pretty incredible story for him to be with us today. But I think one of the more incredible things about your story, sir, is what you're doing now. Tell me how you spend your days and why I couldn't meet up with you till the afternoon.
I day trade.
You day trade. For people who don't know what a day trader is, explain that to them.
Well, I buy stocks and sell stocks. Buy low, sell high, or try to. And so, trying to teach my children how to do it.
So 5 days a week, you're at your computer till the stock market closes in New York?
Well, it was probably closer to seven.
Wow. And why do you do that? What do you get out of it?
It's like playing poker all day long, and I love to play poker.
I understand you took a little money from some of the Doolittle Raiders in poker. Is that true?
Yeah. Right.
Well, we're going to hear about that, his days aboard the USS Hornet. But long before that, his story starts in Europe. You were born in France, and that has to do with World War One. Your father was in the U.S. Navy. How did your parents meet? What's the story you heard growing up?
Well, I really don't know how they met originally. I didn't spend any time with my father, except with a couple of days at a time when he was in port, close to somewhere where I could get to. I was introduced to my father when I was, I think, 7 weeks old. My mother took me to Rotterdam to meet him. He got out of the Navy and stayed with a merchant marine the rest of his life. So
your mother was from France, and he was an American sailor, and they met during World War One.
Yes.
But for most
They might have been Bordeaux.
Uh-huh.
That much I do know. That's about all I know.
Well, they say a lot of good things grow in Bordeaux, so I guess you've added to that legacy. What was it like for you? I mean, here you've lived in France your entire life, and at the age of 19, you're going across the ocean to this brand new country, America. What was that like for you? Was that an adventure? Was that a little nerve-wracking? What do you remember about that?
No, I was well-traveled by that time. I mean, I used to go and meet my father in various countries when he was in port. So going to a strange country was no great shake, let's put it that way.
And you decided not long after you were here, I guess, but you got a college degree pretty quickly and then decided you wanted to go into the service?
Yes.
What was that all about? What did you want to do in the Navy?
I wanted to fly. Part of that, my father was working for American Export at the time, and they were about to form a new airline, American Export Airline. And I guess my dad thought it would be, I had a leg up to get a job with American Export Line, join the Navy, learn to fly, spend some time with the Navy, and then you can join us.
Was there any thought in your mind that joining the Navy at that time might mean you'd be going to war before
long? Going to war, yes, because I joined the Navy actually in 1940, so the war was already started in France.
In France, but not in America?
No.
So you probably had a perspective that a lot of people in this country didn't have yet and wouldn't have until December of 1941. And I ask every veteran about this because every veteran seems to have a memory of December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you found out the Japanese had attacked?
Yes, I do. I got in trouble that day. I was a squadron duty officer. We were stationed in Norfolk. Squadron duty officers, very little to do on Sunday. Most everybody just, you know, went about their business. And I ended up in Norfolk in a movie theater. And the light went on and somebody announced that all military personnel should report back to their base. We had been attacked.
So you were in trouble because you were supposed
to be in the base.
Had the atmosphere or the tenor changed because of that news? Did you sense something different in the base and the guys around you?
Not really, no. We were training. We were a brand new squad. Beside the skipper and the executive officer, the rest of it were boot ensign. I'd got my wings, I think, a month before that. And most of the pilots in the squadron were brand new.
And this squadron would become one of the most famous squadrons of all time because of a tragedy that happened later on. But tell me what it was like at that point. You guys were flying off the deck of the USS Hornet.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of planes were those, and what were they like to fly?
They were the TBDs. They were rather slow, a lot of lift. I didn't think flying off a carrier was any big thing.
Had that been something that came naturally to you, the getting the feel for an airplane, flying it, taking off and landing on carriers? Was that an easy thing for you, or were there some challenges along the way?
I never had any problem.
When you guys left, you took that Hornet out to sea, and I know you had to come around to California because there was some important work you would do here in California, but do you remember what your expectations were? Because you're leaving and you're going to war. What do you think you were looking forward to?
I had no idea. We didn't know we were heading for Tokyo until we're halfway there.
Mm-hmm. And when the Hornet stopped in the East Bay up in Alameda to pick up some B-25s, was that kind of a head-scratcher for you?
We didn't know anything about it then. We kind of thought we were ferrying some planes to Pearl Harbor, actually.
Because you knew what it was like to take off and land on your carrier in a TBD. It probably was pretty precise, I would imagine, right?
Well, it was. I think the only thing that was questionable or that we worried about, well, how were they going to take those big birds off the carrier deck? It's a big, a B-25 is a big plane to take off of the carrier of the Hornet type. I mean, nowadays, it's probably very easy to do. They got longer deck, they got more space, and it wouldn't have put that much question on our mind. But at the time, it was kind of surprising.
So you guys are the Navy pilots on the Hornet. You have your planes you know you're supposed to fly. All of a sudden, there are these Army planes, these big bombers, 16 B-25s on your ship, and obviously the crewmen who would eventually fly them in Doolittle's raid on Tokyo. Did you guys, on the Navy side, interact much with those Army Air Corps guys?
Around the poker table.
And how did that go down? I have the sense there's a story there, that there are some exploits you still remember.
Well, we spent a lot of time playing cards with them. We couldn't fly. They couldn't fly either. So what's to do? One thing I can mention to you, I kind of stick in my mind. We were playing poker in one of the cabins one evening. The executive officer of the ship knocked at the door and opened up and was smiling. He says, well, I see you boys are playing some kind of gambling game. Of course, it's only for chips, right? Oh, yes, sir. You know, it's a court-martial offense in the Navy to gamble. So I said, well, then you won't have any problem if I shuffle your chips a little. And he pulled all the chips in the middle of the table and, well, goodbye, and left us. We never forgot that. The other thing I remember is the Army pilots were a lousy poker player. We took most of their money, I think.
Mm-hmm. What about Doolittle himself? Because I know for some people, they didn't know that name till after the raid, but a lot of people did know the name in the aviation world because he was such an accomplished racer before that.
Yes.
Did you run into him at all on the ship?
I saw him. I wouldn't actually say I met him. We didn't have any long conversation. I spoke to him as you normally would, meeting somebody on the ship, but no close interaction.
April of 1942, you guys are getting closer and closer to Japan, and there's a whole story about why they launched when they did and why they went earlier than they planned to and all of that. But did you guys know what was happening when those B-25s took off?
Well, we had been called to general quarters. As a matter of fact, there's another little anecdote I might mention. The bullhorn came up after the sound of the general quarter trumpet and some kind of excited young sailors. General Quarters, General Quarters, and this time he didn't know sh**. We had picked up, or some destroyer in the outskirts had picked up a picket boat, and we were afraid, of course, that our approach was reported over the radio, so we decided, or the admiral decided to launch. It put a little strain on the Army pilot because they were not prepared for that long a flight.
Were you actually topside watching when they took off?
Yes.
What did that look like? Were you guys taking bets on whether they'd actually get off the deck?
Well, after the first one, we all breathed a sigh of relief. Yeah, we were all wondering where that big bird was going to take off. As a matter of fact, when Doolittle took off, the first plane off, he was handicapped because, of course, he was the first in line, and the deck was loaded with B-25s, so the his takeoff distance was shorter than normally would be. And when he took off, he just disappeared over the bow, just started going down. Everybody thought he might have gone down. And he came back up, and everybody just, yeah.
Did you guys have the sense that you were witnessing history at that moment, or did that not come till later that you figured out how significant?
Well, we didn't know what was going on. I mean, I shouldn't say that. We did hear the captain of the ship tell us what was planned, that Doolittle was heading for Tokyo. Yeah, we knew what was going to happen. Hopefully, everybody was going to make it.
Was there a lot of fervor on the ship when that news started to spread? Because obviously, back here at home, the news that American planes were able to hit Tokyo was a big boost to morale.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Was that a big deal on the ship as well?
The big deal was the fact that they did take off. Everybody was anxiously waiting to see if they were going to make it. Once they got off the deck and they fly, you know, good luck. We didn't think that much about the rest of their flight.
Knowing what you know now, having read about it, heard about it, knowing what conditions those pilots faced, how uncertain their future was, how they had to land and work their way back, and pretty long odds that they faced. You were there when it happened, but yeah. Now knowing what happened in Japan and what they had to go through after they dropped their bombs, what does that make you feel about those men?
Oh, I think it was a tremendous job, let's put it that way. Just to bring up the morale, even if they didn't create any large damage to the Japanese, it certainly did a lot of good for the morale of the American people.
It sent a message, huh?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It also sent the message they were vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. I'm always interested in what was going through people's minds, because here you are, you're a young man. You're 21, 22, 23 years old while this war is going on. Did you feel vulnerable when you were taken off?
No.
Did you feel invincible?
I'm immortal.
Well, you're off to a good start proving that at 94.
Well, what I mean is, you know, to this day, I think if I'd been on that flight on
Midway,
on the Battle of Midway, I would have come back. I mean, if they could come back, so could I.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure some people who've done their homework, who've paid attention long enough, or even listened to the show, they've heard about Ensign George Gay, the sole survivor of Torpedo Squadron 8 at the Battle of Midway. But we told him you were in that squadron, and yet you're here today. So there's a story there how you're still with us, and it was because you didn't fly at Midway.
No, I was in the hospital. There were about four or five. I don't remember. The only one I remember is Whitey Moore. He was dead set on going out and getting some pineapples. Never had pineapple fresh off the field. And I wanted to try sugar cane because I've seen all the kids going down the street sucking on sugar cane and never tried it. We landed at Everfield, and there was a big farm right next to the field, full of pineapples and sugar cane. As I say, five or six, I forgot exactly the number, went out on a midnight requisition.
A midnight requisition usually isn't something that your CO has approved. So this was an improvisational requisition.
Right.
Huh?
We're going to say crime does not pay, but in this case it did pay. We were stealing some sugar cane and some pineapple off the farmer.
And we're going to have to leave you right there in that field for now. When we come back, we'll find out how disastrous that mischief proved to be in the short term, but also how it may just have saved Frenchy Fail's life. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.